Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in, since they going back to showing Action Tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the Anime Action Fan Sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, Mitch and Generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom Froggin, right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your primetime host, Thomas Primetime Mattis, and on this episode, episode 116 of The Prerogative, we take a look at a direct sequel of last week's review, The Rescuers, that came out in 1990 and is officially a part of the Disney Renaissance era. Yes, it is time to fulfill that Australian craze of the 80s, Disney style, as we take a look at The Rescuers Down Under as we continue Disney Month! Yes, we are continuing Disney Month right here with a direct sequel, in fact, of our last review, like I said, The Rescuers, with The Rescuers Down Under, showcasing that this is not the first time. Well, actually, this kind of was the first time Disney really did a direct sequel. I'm, of course, making mention to the recently announced Frozen 2, and people all shocked, like, oh, Disney did a sequel, and they're doing a sequel to the they're calling it the greatest movie of all time. We all know that's bullshit, but, like, the highest grossing movie, which, by the way, has anybody else noticed that they've cheated? People have changed to saying the greatest movie of all, greatest animated movie to all time, to the highest grossing animated movie of all times. Anybody notice that little twist to it? Mind you, I'm just laughing at all the shock and surprise. Like, well, this isn't the first time Disney has done direct sequels. You have The Rescuers Down Under, you have Fantasia 2000, you have Winnie the Pooh. Pixar seems to make tons of money off doing this. We know for a fact there are in the works for Ratatouille 2. There's Finding Dory, which is supposedly in production. Incredibles 2, which everybody always keeps talking about. Monsters University, Toys, Cars 2, the James Bond edition, apparently. The spinoff of Cars, Planes, and then its sequel, Planes, Fire, and Rescue? Because. Why? I have no idea. It just makes money. And I did go see Planes and Cars too. God help me. And then, of course, how can we forget it? I was about to say it, but I wanted to save it for last. You know, Toy Story, Toy Story 2, Toy Story 3. And Toy Story 4, The Search for Spock. And Toy Story 5, This is Spartacus. And Toy Story 6, The Return of the King. Oh, wait, they haven't made those yet? They're only in production for 4. how can we also forget that, you know, just because they're not made bored at the theaters, not brought to the theaters and feature films. You know, let's not forget Disney has had a long, time doing sequels in direct-to-video, particularly in the 90s with the Disney Renaissance, because, I have too much pride in Disney Renaissance not to knock it for making a buck, because let's not act like Disney's the only one who will do it. But, yeah, let's not overestimate Disney's attempt to squeeze 10 million out of a penny. Alright, just like calm ourselves there. Actually, I was watching the Nostalgia Critic's little joke video they released today about, revealing the plot of Frozen 2, which I thought was funny. But it's like, I was almost hoping that when I clicked the video, it would be that video of Patton Oswalt on Community, like describing what episode 7 was going to be with Galactus entering the Star Wars universe. I was really hoping that's what it would be. But what he did was pretty funny, and of course, it was all clickbait, to prepare people for next week's review. The Nostalgia Critic and Angry Video Game Nerd reviewing the 2014 Ninja Turtles movie, which I kind of was actually a little sad about, because he's like, oh, you have that much distrust in the way he was doing in the bit. Like, well, I will review anything you want to. I'm like, oh my god, he's actually going to review Dragon Ball Evolution. Apparently that still is the one he won't review. I find that very hilarious. But really not relevant to our review proper. But this is definitely an interesting review. It's going to be, for many reasons, as we'll get into the review. This movie does have a bit of a dubious honor, which I think is unfortunate, because I think it's a very important legacy. Because it is technically part of the Disney Renaissance, it's actually the least successful box office, making around $28 million when you round up. But with that being said, there's very important history with this. This was one of the first elements to use the CAPS system, the computer animated process system, which became a huge part of Disney in the 90s, in the Disney Renaissance. And it marks the first true collaboration of Disney with Pixar. Unfortunately, the marketing didn't really highlight that, as it would do in later films. So for that reason, it has a lot of importance to it. And again, you also have a lot of big name animators that also worked on this. Mark Head, famous for his supervising roles on the females in the Renaissance, worked on Bernard. He also worked on Bianca, Nikki Renner. And I apologize mispronouncing that name. Worked on Wilbur, Russ Edmund, worked on Cody. You had Glenn Keane working on The Eagle. You had Ruby and Equita, famous for doing, can't remember if it's Mufasa or Simba, or adult Simba, mind you, working on Jake, and so on. So you had a lot of the big name artists working on this project too, so a lot of important people worked on this. So I think very historically important, especially considering it is that first use of the CAP system. So with all that being said, let's get into our review proper, which means time for our synopsis. So ladies and gentlemen, taking place during the, Australian fan craze of the 80s, or being influenced by it at least, since this was actually in 1990, our story starts in the Australian outback, where a young boy, Cody, is captured by a animal poacher by the name of Percival C. McLeach, who's wanted by the Australian Rangers for capturing and selling rare and endangered animals. And in this case, Cody is trying to save a rare golden eagle named Maruta. McLean is trying to find out where Maruta and her eggs are, since he's already killed her mate. But Cody is determined to try to protect its location. this capture is capture. Well, the mouse that McLean uses to capture Cody just happens to be part of the Rescue Aid Society, and message is sent all the way back to New York, where they send their two best agents, Bernard and Miss Bianca, to Australia on the back of the new Albatross airline, Wilbur, played by Johnny Candy, bears mentioning, to go and save Cody. When they get there, they are aided by a kangaroo mouse by the name of Jake as they travel through the outback to save Cody and the Golden Eagle. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Rescuers Down Under. And welcome back, and let's get started with it as we usually do with the music. And we really only have the score to talk about. I mean, there's a couple of simple songs. You know, the Rescue Aid Society song, I think, if I remember right, was sung for a bit. But there really isn't any songs per se. It really is only the musical score. The score is done by Bruce Broughton, which he is actually famous. He's done a lot of big work throughout the years. You know, I was looking at his playlist before. You know, he did the Tiny Toons main theme. He worked on wrong notes. Should go back down here. He worked on Harry and the Hendersons, the Monster Squad, Big Shots, Young Sherlock Holmes, Silverado, which he got an Oscar nomination for. Honey, I Blew Up the Kids, the Homeward Bound series, which has some very good musical pieces. So he has done some good work. And you know, I really enjoyed the score. I think the music is a huge step up and a huge improvement over the original in this case. Because the score does have that epic, you know, first of all, you have all those sort of traditional Australian instruments that are really well placed within the orchestra. That does give it that Australian feel. There's a particular instrument. I can't remember what it is. If I probably did notes like I really should do and look some of this stuff up, I could probably remember it, but I don't think you would get what exactly I'm trying to talk about. I just can't think of the name, though, of the instrument. But it's that woodwind traditional Australian instrument that has that very unique sound that is really particular to the Australian outback. That's really well placed throughout most of the music here. And just overall, the score is just really well done and has that great epic, grandiose feel of an adventure to it. That really, really works. And more importantly, in the movie itself, it really, really works. You know, especially some of the epic scenes in this movie. The score just matches it so well, and it's so well done. Again, I said the score was really well done in the original Rescuers. I guess in this case, it's here there was a decision to do no songs. And that by itself, amazing as it is an improvement over the songs that were in The Rescuers. You know, sometimes deciding to do no songs is just as good of a choice as it is to do any song. You know, because sometimes there's no place for a song, and the way you're telling the story, songs are not needed. And this is one of those cases, and I think this works wonderfully. So overall, I really, really enjoyed the score. Just had a very epic, grandiose feel. I loved the way the Australian instruments were introduced along with traditional orchestra here, and that really helped give the soundtrack a very unique feel. I would definitely love to listen to the soundtrack on its own, because it has just a unique feel to it. And so overall, I thought the music was wonderful. Again, in conjunction with the movie, the scores does everything it needs to. Again, it gives those heightened adjectives, those heightened verbiage that really help express the emotions going on in the movie, and yet it doesn't overtake it. The music's there, you hear it, you recognize that it's there, but it's not overtaking the animation or the story that's going on screen for that purpose. And that brings us to animation. I love the animation. You just have to see the first shot and you automatically know this is Disney Renaissance. Because the Disney Renaissance was just so different. I mean, it's really amazing. Watch Black Cauldron and then watch The Little Mermaid. It is such a jump. There's such softness, the bold line work, and yet it's smoothness. All these are elements that just scream Disney Renaissance. And, really harken back to things like Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella and Snow White. Just that those soft, round, bold colors. The warm feel and everything. It's right here. With the Rescuers, there's a lot of dark colors, and it worked for what it was going, but it had this very dark, grayish feel to it. But this is just... This is... I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Now the dark clouds are hiding now. It's gonna be a bright, bright, bright sunny day. I mean, literally, that's what it screams to be. It's like a bright, bright, sunshiny day. Because it's like, boom. And it's not just because of the location. Well, location does have a lot to do because it allows the element for it to be very sunny. But it's just like, from the first, 3 seconds of this film that this is going to be a vastly different film than The Rescuers, just by the brightness of the colors. And just, again, it's that, like I said, it just screams Disney Renaissance, and just, I'm just so in love with that art style. I'm almost biased, I guess. But again, it's, the improvement here isn't necessarily that it's a better designs. It's just that, here are designs, we know what we have to do with them, and we're just making them more slick and more smooth. And it's like, more refined. And really, that's really what the improvement is. It's that this is so much more refined than what they were doing. Well, I mean, at least in character designs, the character designs are refined, which we can get into now. Because really, Bizarre and Bianca's design doesn't change that much. But again, it's the refinement and the fact that it's been 12 years and animators can do more now. And that improvement of technology with the use of different technology. I liked Cody. I thought Cody worked very well. He had a very sort of, let's say, safe design, but again, he had that very every kid feel to him. So in that sense, I thought it worked, because when you're a kid or an adult trying to pretend to think you're a kid, which sounds completely wrong and may raise some questions, but I think you can definitely get into the emotional impact of what this kid is doing. Because he has such a simple design that you can feel like, hey, that kind of feels like me at that age. So, in that sense, the design worked. McLeach, is just... I mean, at least I think there's a lot of people are going to sit here and say that, you know, Tarzan maybe stole a bit of its villain from this one. And certainly I can see elements of that here. But this is just, you know, just the roughness of his design that just, again, whereas all the other characters have a smoothness and a refinement to him, him and Johanna, for that matter, is just absolutely rough. There's a rough and a grittiness to their design that really separates them from all the other characters. I just thought of it, and it's like, there's another movie where had this sort of same character, this evil character. I want to say it was an Ernest movie. For whatever reason. Like, Ernest Saves Camp or something like that. But because, again, in fact, for that matter, McLean's kind of reminds me a lot of, like, an evil Ernest. Yeah, it's just, I thought they did a great job. Just that grit and just roughness about him that's very much different from all the other characters you see really makes him, and Johanna for that matter, stand out. Wilbur and Jake, again, really well designed. Again, Wilbur really not much different than Orville. Again, and I kind of didn't make mention of this. I think shame on him, but it is kind of very funny again. And a nice shout-out to Fly. You know, you have these two albatrosses, Orville and Wilbur. Shout-out to Orville and Wilbur of Flying fame. You would think I remember the name of the brothers. God damn it. as it turned out. Yeah. I'm stuck on the Wilbur, goddammit. Wilbur Wright, thank you. The Wright brothers. For whatever reason, I had to scroll down my notes. The Wright brothers. goddammit. You know, if I was the type of person that really had heavily edited this podcast, I wouldn't be so worried. But I'm not that. But again, his design, really not much different. But again, much smoother, sleeker, more refined. And Jake has that sort of nice little souvenir, like, the very handsome Australian man feel to him. That was very popular in the late 80s. And mind you, we bring up that whole Australian craze, because for those who don't know, there was a huge Australian craze in the 80s. You know, with things like Crocodile Dundee. And some big movies that came out of Australia, like Mad Max. This actually had a large part in due to there was a huge push by the Australian Film Board in the 80s to get Australian films out there in the entertainment world and really push Australia and Australian films. And so, you know, it also got Australian actors in international filming in other locations, and just got a lot of big name and a lot of popularity and a lot of focus on Australia. Action animation, oh my god, what? The action animation is beautiful. I mean, I'm not just talking about fight scenes and things like that, but the most prominent here is the flight scenes. Oh my god. Hayao Miyazaki would be goddamn proud. And mind you, I say that because he is a huge fan of flying. Everybody knows it. And like, these are some of the most beautiful flight scenes you will ever see. And I think everybody knows that. And just again, this, you know, hand-drawn animation in conjunction with a computer graphics system to create this. So this is why I don't hate CG. And this is why I believe they're, you know, CG and hand-drawn can work together. I just wish Disney would allow it to happen. But still, this is just gorgeous. I mean, this is, how old is this movie? This is, 25 years old now? And it's still gorgeous. It's still beautiful than most things that come out animation-wise these days. I mean, it's just... Those flying scenes are just a work of art. And the feel of adventure and flight is... In particular, when he goes flying off the waterfall. It's like, that shot. It's like, ladies and gentlemen, your money, your trailer money shot, right? In fact, they did use that shot for the trailer. Because that's what it was. Ladies and gentlemen, your trailer money shot. Please remember to change pants when needed. And, which is probably a horrible thing for me to say, because I'm possibly comparing this on the same level as NXT Our Evolution. Which, again, is not a bad thing, but not quite that level. But, you know, the joke still works. Anyways, absolutely nobody got what I was saying except for, like, the five people who listened to this and also listened to WrestleCast and the CM2 Wrestling Reviews. Hi there, Maddie J and TWK. But the action animation was just absolutely tremendous and wonderful. And I just love watching those action scenes over and over and over again. Because they were just beautiful. And whether it be the flying scenes or, you know, the final scene where they're trying to escape McLeach. Even some of the more comedic action scenes with Wilbur or with the Frill Lizard when they're captured in McLeach's lair. That all worked very fine as well, and I really enjoyed that. And the backgrounds and the special effects, I mean, my God, how many times have I said that one of the unsung heroes of Disney Renaissance is the backgrounds and special effects? Because just absolutely tremendous here. Done wonderfully. I love them. The backgrounds just... All the locations just seemed exotic and amazing. Like, oh my God, I want to go there. It made you feel alive, and it allowed for such emotional investment in, you know, what these characters were going through. In particular for Cody, who really cared about the animals and his land. And you felt that emotional investment just based off the beauty. And the special effects, the part of, you know, I'll say particle effects, but, you know, like the splashing and all that, and rain and everything. Just really well done. The animation is just such an improvement. You know, in some cases, it's like, again, the technology and the time are showcased obviously here. I mean, it's two different eras of Disney. The Rescuers, the first Rescuers is just firmly placed in that just old, like, 70s Xerox style. But this is Disney Renaissance. This is just back to that hand-drawn, back to that, and with assistance of computer-animated systems, just makes it smooth, slick, stylistic, yeah, at the same time, round and warm and fuzzy and everything. It's just such an improvement. And even the little improvements, like I said, with character design, with Bernard and Bianca, you know, everything I said about their character design last episode is really in place here. It's just refined. So again, that every American, every sort of every guy feel, that every American feels like is sort of that traditional look of the American. It's just refined to perfection here on Bernard. And that very sort of maternal, sensual feel of Bianca is just refined here as well. So with that, time for a little break where I'm going to play some promos for some people who do so much better jobs than I do. And yes, that is the Jew in me talking. But I'm going to play their promos. I hope you listen to their stuff. And when we come back, we're going to get into acting and into story. After these messages,
we'll be right back. Greetings, podcast listener. Do you like... Gotcha, Mom! Or maybe...
Dragon Flame!
How about... Tatsuo! Ganino! Or...
In the year 1999, an abandoned alien battle fortress crash-landed on the planet Earth. Our most brilliant scientists and engineers spent the next 10 years reconstructing the damaged ship and studying its highly advanced space technology called Robotech.
Do you remember...
Star Blazers.
Or this.
The year is after Colony 195. As the world constantly changes in the chaotic era, there are two mobile suits that could turn humans into the ultimate weapon. The Wing Zero and the Epion.
Or maybe even this.
After the desire for blood rules all, the only hope left is the one they call D.
Or this.
Gene, grappler ships dead ahead!
It wouldn't be fun otherwise. Let's do it!
Or...
If Cardis is allowed to be reborn, she'll destroy Marmo as well as Lodos!
Or have you seen the latest episode of...
And just like that, everything changed. At that terrible moment, in our hearts, we knew. Home was a pen. Humanity, cattle.
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then you should check out Anime Freaks, hosted by Dr. Bill Robinson and me, Gene Hendricks. Anime Freaks is a monthly podcast covering all things anime. It is available at twotruefreaks.com and on iTunes under Two True Freaks Presents Anime Freaks.
I guess you weren't so tough after all, were you? Now it's time to send you to the next dimension.
291 original episodes.
This can't be. It's still going up.
325 manga chapters.
You act innocent, but you're deadly.
Time to die!
Dozens of characters, hundreds of enemies, and a whole lot of violence.
That kind of violence is pointless!
You see, Super Saiyans tend to be a bit violent.
Oh, crap!
Join hosts Donovan and Jesse as they cover the arrival of the Saiyans, the journey to Namek, the battle with Frieza, the mystery of the androids, and the terror of Majin Buu.
I lied when I said you could go. At least partially lied, for I will let you go to another dimension.
The Next Dimension, a Dragon Ball Z podcast. Join the fight at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com.
See ya.
Gather together from the far reaches of the internet. Our assembled a network of podcasts dedicated to the first and greatest superhero, Superman. The Superman Podcast Network is dedicated to covering all aspects of the Superman legend, featuring
The Thrilling Adventures of Superman,
Golden Age Superman,
The Superman Fan Podcast,
Superman in the Bronze Age,
From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast,
The Schuster Herald Podcast,
It's Superman,
The Carazerald Podcast,
The Amateur Steel, a John Henry Allen podcast,
The World's Best Podcast,
and
Radio Kale from supermanhomepage.com.
Join hosts
Michael Bradley,
John Wilson,
Billy Hogan,
Charlie Niemeyer,
J. David Weider,
Jeffrey Taylor,
Michael Bailey,
Scott Gardner,
Sam Rizzo,
Danny Sapp,
Matthew Epps,
I'm Isaac,
I'm Adam,
Dave Yunus, and co-host Scotty V
at supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
And welcome back, and let's get right back into it with acting, which means it's time to go over our cast list. So once again returning, we have Bob Newhart as Bernard and Eva Gabor as Miss Bianca. You have Tristan Rogers as Jake, Adam Ryan as Cody, George C. Scott as Percival C. McLeach. And I, by the way, I apologize for calling him McLean again. Me and names. I apologize. And John Candy as Wilbur. Who has a bit more of a presence in this than Orville does. Because, again, if you're going to hire a big name like John Candy, I guess you can't just give him one scene. Probably could, but I guess he decided, well, we're paying for him, so we have to give him some more comedy. And don't get that me saying that I hate John Candy in this role, because I thought he was absolutely hilarious. I mean, John Candy is hilarious. I've not seen a role that he has done that I hate by any means, I would find it hard-pressed to probably find a role that he did that I would hate. God damn it, one of my favorite movies of all time is Cool Running, and a large part of that is him, you know. Do you have a problem with that? No problem, man. Him saying that, like, I love this movie. I love it. And by the way, that is a Disney movie, so not completely off track. But anyways, so I thought he did a good job. This goes more to a story element aspect, which I think we'll get into a little bit. But once again, Bob Newhart and Eva Gabor just nail their roles. They have less of a presence. And again, you know, this is hard to talk about because it is the downfall of the story, is the reduced presence of Bernard and Bianca. Though they have a much stronger appearance in the back half, I don't know if they make up for their lack of presence in the first half of the film. Or for that matter, the first, like, two-thirds of the film. Because it's really less half and more, like, they really only major in that last third of the film. But it's a major presence. It's like, the first third is really just about Cody and his interactions with Bleach. The second half, you have a little bit of Bianca. You basically have the journey part of them trying to get to the location, but it's still mostly on Cody and showing him try to escape and everything. And then it's really heavily, you know, because that's when Bianca and Bernard get there. But Bob Newhart, just, again, that every guy feel to his voice and that just natural warm comedy, nails Bernard with it. And Eva Gabor, again, that just maternal feel to her. Yeah, which makes sense. I mean, talking about main actress on Green Acres. God, I feel old. Kids, if you're listening to this podcast with your adults and they're right now groaning, it's not because I'm singing bad. Well, it is because my singing is absolutely horrible. But it's because I just made them, along with myself, feel absolutely old. Because that was a show that was out before you were born, and we remember watching. Well, they may, depending on how old your parents might be, they either were alive when it came out, or they remember being kids and watching it on TV in reruns. Yeah. I'm gonna get some hate mail and get beat up for some of this. But again, back on topic, they did a great job of just nailing the roles that they did 12 years ago. So just wonderful job for them just to, because it feels like they never missed a beat with how they were performing their roles before, and definitely also adding uniqueness and obviously evolving their characters' relationship with each other. That I thought was great. Tristan Roberts, I thought, did a great job as Jake, whose seemingly main goal in the storyline of Jake was, like, he is the tension and, you know, trying to, the possible alpha male who could steal Bianca away from Bernard. And he's jealous, but no, not so jealous. No, poor Bernard. And it seemed like I'm making light of that. It's just, there are certain elements of the story that felt unnecessary, and that was one of them. And again, that's not Tristan Roberts' fault. That's the hard part about it, is he did an absolutely wonderful job. And there are parts where, you know, Jake does feel like he earns his spot in the story. But, you know, it's almost somewhat predictable, but it's not, it doesn't completely hurt the story, is the thing about it. So I thought he did a great job as Jake. Adam Ryan, again, just, he, like, the lady who played Penny, again, has a sort of every kid feel to his voice that I thought worked very, very well. That leaves us with our antagonist, which is George C. Scott, and oh my God, Something I loved about it, I loved every scene of this movie that McLeach was on. Because, goddamn it, every moment I got to hear George C. Scott play McLeach, I mean, it sounded like he was just absolutely in love and having so much fun with this role. It's like, oh my god, I just love him in this role. Every moment he's on screen is fun because you're on the verge of laughing your ass off because he's just like, it's so cartoony, but it's so evil at the same time, and he just nails it. He gets that balance and just absolutely nails it. I think if this movie had a better story, he might be a more memorable villain. And I think he should be because, like I said, and George C. Scott makes it. George C. Scott makes this villain unique because that voice and everything is just like, oh my god, he nails it. And yeah, you could say he could have a bit more Australian in him. But you know what? I don't care. See, I never got the... he was supposed to be Australian. And he came off to me as like he was like maybe an American poacher who had moved to Australia and was trying to go after all these rare animals. And that's the thing, is like that's one of the unique sort of things that was very underlined that I noticed about this film, is that like McLeach felt like he was an outsider who was there taking from the land, whereas you had Cody, who is this insider trying to protect the land. And it's very underplayed, and I think if they would have saw that and played with that more in the story, story could have been so much better. But, you know, just on voice acting, George C. Scott, just like I said, nailed McLeach. And I would be remiss not to mention that Frank Weckler, the Animal Man himself, voiced both Mahute, the Golden Eagle, and Jonah, the lizard henchman of McLeach, and did a wonderful job in both. Literally, Scott McNeil's whole bit about, oh, we have a bird, we could go with a bird to Frank. Let's go with Frank, he takes direction better. Disney apparently literally went with that in this case because Frank Weckler was the bird. The bird, 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 the bird is the bird, the bird, 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 surfing bird. And I have no idea why I went into that Family Guy bit. I gotta stop now. I'll stop by segueing into story. Now, I've kind of made mention that I feel the story is kind of a letdown. It definitely is. I don't think that the story is as good as it is in The Rescuers, but it's still a good story, that's the thing. I'm talking in comparison to The Rescuers story. The original Rescuers, that story was a bit more streamlined, had a bit more adventure feel. You had a more of Bianca Bernard in there, and if felt important, and there was a lot more build-up and everything. And so they really streamlined and simplified the story, and that worked to a disadvantage. You know, here, you know, I kind of made mentioned is, you know, you have the emotion of Cody, and this is why I say I think if they would have played with that whole element of maybe McLeach being an outsider, like an American or British or somebody else who's stealing these animals and Cody's trying to save it, that would have, I think, held that those first two-thirds together a lot more and made it more sense of Bianca and Bernard taking their time to get there. But with all that being said, by no means is it still a terrible film. It's just, again, there's a lot more complications to the overall plot. It's still the very simple plot of somebody's in trouble, you have these mice who are gonna go and save them because, again, and the same theme is there of no matter how who you are or what you can, who you are, how small you are, how big you are, whatever, you can always do something. And they definitely, I think, improve on it as well. Because they show Bernard improving. improving on himself and getting better, you know, and deciding, I'm just going to take Jake's advice and I'm going to, you know, take control of this Razorback Warthog. Which, by the way, it's like, Pumbaa? And oh, the shame, it was a shame. At the thought of my name, when I got downtrodden, down in the hills, every time of my, hey, Pumbaa, not in front of the kid. Why am I going into these bits? I have no idea. This is what happens when I'm in a Disney mood. This is my hashtag Disney side, okay? So they definitely improved on the overall theme there. But again, it just, I guess this goes more to pacing. The pacing of the film was okay, but they would just randomly go to a comedy scene with Wilbur, with the field hospital mice that are preparing to give him a shot. And it's like, I wanted to hold up a sign that said, is this trip really necessary? But again, just to go back to it, the main plot. Even though you have these complications, the thing they don't do is that they don't lose it. They overcomplicate it a bit, and I say that because they add a bit too much baggage scenes that I think can be cut out, but still, the main focus is there, and they never leave it. And when you add in the improved animation, the improved music, and still the wonderful voice cast, again, it still retains that core heart and that core warmth that I talked about last episode that the Rescuers had. And that's, I think, very important to the movie and why it's still good, despite the story not being as good as the original. And that, because the story is only not as good as the original on a technical level because of the more baggage. And, you know, it's like, we need more comedy in here. Well, Wilbur will provide that comedy. I mean, really, the only scene that I really felt that was like, just like, why did this scene need to be here? I mean, mostly because, hell, it even felt like a scene that could have been at the end of the credits or anything. You know, and I'm talking about the scene at the end of the movie where everything's happy after, but what's the final scene we see? We see Wilbur sitting on them eggs as they're about to hatch. And it's like, calling out to everybody, like, hey, where's everybody at? It's like, that just didn't feel like it needed to be there. But outside of that, it's like, even the scenes that felt like were baggage didn't detract too much. It's just that they feel like baggage. So, even though it has, as I keep calling it, this baggage, the film still works and it still has that core heart. Like I said, I felt it improved on the overall theme, as I made mention of being, you know, no matter who you are, you're able to do something. And like I said, part of that improvement is through the evolution of Bernard and Bianca's relationship, which I didn't feel was, I felt it was important, but not too important, or at least they didn't play it as important, or at least make it feel played as important, though it was always lingering there, and it really was. So I really don't know what to make it either way. But definitely, they used it in enhancing that idea of improving yourself. You know, he eventually takes Jake's lesson and uses it, and it helps them. But also showcasing, you know, Bianca has this belief that, like, I know Bernard will be there. He always is there to save the day at the last moment. And, you know, sure enough, he is. And just brilliant theme. And that's a really scary ending scene right there with the alligators and everything. I was almost expecting a yell with that fall. I mean, they had it in the original. But, you know, so overall, despite the baggage that this film has, I think it still retains its heart. And I think that's a very important thing to acknowledge here. is that despite the baggage and the extra scenes that complicate the plot a little bit, because it sometimes takes away. It's like you're in the middle of this plot and you really care and you have all this emotion, and now we're going to go to a comedy scene. Or now we're going to go to the, I'm trying to get to, you know, we're with Cody and we're emotionally invested in Cody, and now we're going to jump to Bernard, Bianca, and Jake, who should be there by now, but for whatever reason are still traveling by water snake. It's like, there were some scenes that didn't meet there, and they could have sped it up, and they could have put Bianca and Bernard with Cody sooner. Just overall, they could have streamlined their approach with this film as far as the story, and I think it would have worked a little bit better. But at the same point in time, they don't lose their heart. And that's the really important thing here, I think I want to emphasize, is that despite the fact that I think overall that the story isn't as good as the original, the improvements in the music and the animation, and just, again, the return of solid acting, just keep, you know, make up for the reduction in story here, and allows this story to keep that heart, that just warm heart, that just makes the Rescuer movies feel good and warm and gooey inside. Just make it a joy to watch. So, at the end of the day, I give The Rescuers Down Under a 3.5, but I'll give it a 4 out of 5, I'm sorry. I don't know why I said 3.5. I was like, wait a minute, if I'm saying it's just as, if it keeps it afloat and has the same heart, it's got to have the same score. So it's like, I have no idea what I was thinking. But 4 out of 5 for me, it has a lot of historical importance to it. It's got beautiful animation, a really underrated soundtrack that helped keep the sort of baggage that the story adds on in check, and makes it still a very enjoyable film to watch. And I know I'll definitely watch it again, because I just had a blast watching this, especially for George C. Scott's portrayal of McLeach. I mean, just again, nailed that role. So, 4 out of 5 for me for The Rescuers Down Under. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember, if any emails or any comments you want to send the show, there are simple ways you can contact the show. One, you can email us at absolutionnetwork@gmail.com. Or let me start that over. I kind of like, wait, what are you saying? It's late at night, folks, and I apologize. You can email us at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. That's absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. You can also find us on Stitcher, like us, leave us a comment there, and listen to us on www.stitcher.com. You can also find us on Facebook by searching for the Absolution Network, and always you can find our website at www.an.132productions.com. Also, while you're there, make sure you check out all the other 132 Productions content. That, of course, includes the anime cast, the Otaku Momentum, Shin Tiger Girl, his wrestling and anime, and video game videos of Shin Tiger talks. It seems now like every day he releases a video, which, yeah, hey, it's that dude with the straw hat, and he's always funny. John Ramos and his toku and voiceover and even anime videos. He does wonderful stuff with that, like talking toku. And of course, if I haven't said it before, he has a role on Alpha Omega. Congrats, man, on that. And of course, make sure you check out all my other podcasting stuff on the Absolution Network. CMG's Wrestling Reviews, Tom's Top 10, the Intergalactic Graphic Review, maybe much more in the future. Of course, there's also Comic Book Crazy featuring my old comic book podcast, and called Comic Book Crazy, oddly enough, and Hexcast and Spectacular Webs. You can find them at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And, of course, you can always check out my Godzilla podcast, Tokyo SOS, which you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And also make sure you check out all our friends on the sidebar of the site. This, of course, includes Michael Bailey and Views to the Long Box, along with From Crisis to Crisis, that he does with Jeffrey Taylor, Spidey Dude and the Clone Saga Chronicles, Steven Slaker and the Critical Hit Podcast, and of course Scott Gardner and the Tutu Freaks Podcasting Network. So that is it for this episode of Tom Sprogative. Next week, well, we're staying in Disney Renaissance because we're going to get the choir out and we're going to kick the tires and light the fires because we're going to show you what a hero is all about. Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. We're going back to ancient Greece as we are going to rediscover the story of Hercules, Hercules, Hercules. So until next time, my Tsunami Generation, stay golden.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.